Welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, James Starking.
And me, Jonathan Gullis.
We're delighted today to be joined by someone who spent pretty much a decade in government, also crossed over into opposition, the DEFRA man, really, Mr. DEFRA, we can call you, ending on 2 years as Secretary of State, but spent a hell of a long time there. And I had the pleasure of working with George Eustace, who joins us today, during my time there with Michael, which was great fun. And we're going to kind of focus on opposition, because before that, there'll be a lot of people that remember, but maybe not everyone. You were also with David Cameron's leadership campaign and his press secretary, and before that, director of comms. Thanks so much for joining us, George.
It's a pleasure.
We kind of wanted to look back a bit at that. As much as I would definitely love to do an episode on DEFRA, hopefully we'll get
you
a hold.
You are obsessed with DEFRA.
I'm obsessed with
every
DEFRA.
Episode DEFRA gets a shout out.
It's the best department. I'm sure George will agree.
It is. I loved it. And I actually didn't want to be anywhere else, but it was a good... I enjoyed my 9 years there.
Yeah.
Or enjoyed most of it. There were moments.
There's always a bit of a... Probably less so like floods or things like that, but...
Yeah, it's the department where things go wrong in the natural environment and you get the blame for it even though you couldn't do anything about it.
And get relentlessly lobbied on things, animal rights, like MPs and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, everybody seems to know better when it comes to policy in general. Yeah. I think, but in particular in DEFRA.
But we thought we'd kind of focus on. We've got a kind of election coming up, and there's always talk in the media about kind of government versus opposition and so on. And you said something to me a while ago that just made me think about doing an episode on it, which was, because you've got direct experience of this, which is one of the hardest things to do in opposition is to go from being a party of opposition to being perceived by the electorate as a party of government. But you did that. So you were part of a group of people that actually managed to take a Tory party that had lost three elections, had been in opposition for a long time, and had gone from that opposition vibe where you just attack the government of the day, and with David, convinced the electorate that you were a party ready for government. So we thought we'd kind of look at that, given you've got direct experience of it. But we always start on every single episode with, how did you get into politics? Because you've done quite a few jobs in politics, been involved in also more than one party. So how and why, when you were back in Cornwall on a farm, did you think, I'm going to leave one of the most beautiful places... I know you still represent there, but kind of leave one of the most beautiful places in the country and spend more time in Westminster being in politics.
Yeah, in my case, and I think it's often the case for MPs, although rarely are they given credit. There's always accusations of career politicians and so on. But in my case, I wasn't planning to go into politics. I went into the family business and worked there for 10 years. And it was a farming business. We used to do a lot of strawberries, cauliflowers, all sorts of other things as well. But the business went through a very difficult financial period in the mid-1990s. It had expanded in the early 90s and took on quite a bit of additional debt to do that expansion. And we were hit very badly by the policy of the ERM. So joining the exchange rate mechanism, it was then called, the forerunner to the euro.
I didn't know that.
Which obviously became a catastrophe. And very high interest rates exacerbated some other problems that we had. So there were weather events that affected the business, but... The ERM and that high interest rate and credit squeeze really pushed us over the edge. Mm. And we went through a period, our family business in 1995, of actually being in receivership and being in an intense litigation fight with our bank, Barclays Bank.
That must be particularly hard when it's a family business.
It was incredibly traumatic, but also very formative episode in my life. I was 22, 23 at the time. Yeah. I saw all sorts of things happen in that world around receivership, insolvency, the way that banks and lawyers conduct themselves in these situations that I just felt was wrong, and it politicized me. And I ended up doing a two-week high court trial as a litigant in person because we didn't have finances. I was up against a team of lawyers costing £50,000 a week, and I had to fight our case. Now, in the end, there was a settlement, and we came through that. But even when peace broke out, if you like, and we were back to business as normal, in a funny kind of way, I found myself missing the fight and the acrimony. And so I was drawn inexorably to the debate about the euro. People forget, before the argument about the EU, there was a ferocious debate about the euro. And the thing is about all debates European, as we all now know, there's always plenty of acrimony to go around if, if you want a fight about things. And so my first campaign job was with Business for Stirling. That's where I met Dominic Cummings. We were both in our late 20s. And, you know, we were then, Conservatives had just gone into opposition. This was 99. They were in a terrible state at that point, you know, in the days of William Hague, struggling to find their footing. And the Business for Stirling campaign was sort of a rare example of effectively a centre-right grouping that formed an alliance with trade unions, Labour Party, the Green Party, even, and others to fight membership of the Euro. And that was how I cut my teeth and got into politics.
Oh, well, and that's where I got my job title from, for Vote Leave. I think you, at least part of it, you were network manager.
I was the network manager, yes, or, you know, Dominic being Dominic, used to call it effing network, usually had the prefix effing. But my job was to go around and build the coalition, make people feel valued, get businesses involved in particular, focusing on getting businesses involved, and do a lot of the regional media. So all the things that Dominic Cummings famously never did very, very well.
All the things he then got me to do. And when I said, what's my job title? They said, oh, network manager. I was like, what does that even mean?
And sounds just like got some IT role or something, but it's really about building those friendship groups and coalition and building the wider base of support.
Well, Paul Stevenson said to me, if it's good enough for George Eustace, it's going to be good enough for you. So, and I was happy with it. So,
that is where I started. Network manager was my first job.
It's worked out very well for you, reasonably well for me, so that's good. And so, but moving on a bit, so you worked for David on his leadership campaign. Were you a kind of part of David Cameron's group prior to that? Did you see the potential in David?
Yes.
Others?
Well,
because he wasn't favourite going into that.
No, he wasn't. I guess I would put it a different way. So before that, it was actually Michael Howard who recruited me to basically run the press office. And technically, I was his deputy press secretary. Guy Black in those days was his press secretary. But whereas Guy Black would be based in Parliament and by his side, we did interviews, my role was to run the press office. And it was a reasonably big office. We had about 30 press officers by that stage going into the 2005 election. And because when you're in opposition, if you're not doing it, nobody else is. Yeah. So the party, when you're in government, is, you know, slimmed down to basically half a dozen people, if that. Because everything's being done by SPADs and the departmental press offices, which are huge. If you're in opposition, it doesn't matter whether there's some, you know, row with a train strike or a plane that gets broke down or an environment issue, whatever the issue, it comes into your office. And so we had a setup of about 30 people, and I ran that into the 2005 election. And then what happened is during the run-up to that 2005 election, well, I've got very good relations with him now. I found it quite difficult dealing with DD, as he was always known, David Davis. He was, there were times when I couldn't get him to do the day programme at 7:50 because he wanted the 8:10 slot, and then the Lib Dems would end up getting a slot. And I found it, I think it was understood that if he won, basically I'd be a goner from the press office anyway. And I actually felt that the party really did need to do something differently. And I'd been quite impressed by David Cameron and what I'd seen of him in the various roles that he had in Michael Howard's shadow cabinet. He was the underdog. Nobody expected him to win. But I thought, let's just give him a punt. And in particular, Oliver Letwin was backing him as well. I rated Oliver Letwin because, you know, I dealt with him a lot despite everything that happened after during Brexit. Oliver Letwin was an intellectual titan.
Generally considered one of the
Oliver was the sort of anchor man who basically kept the show on the road pretty much all the time that I was in opposition, both under, you know, Michael Howard and then definitely under David Cameron. And so that was how it worked. And I think David Cameron, I said to Rachel Whetstone, look, she was Michael Howard's chief of staff. I'm not going to hang around. I'm going to go. She knew David Cameron well and just said to him, look, you should just get George on board to help your campaign.
You didn't know him well at that point?
I knew him reasonably well, but he didn't approach me directly. Okay. Well, he did eventually, but it was really indirectly through Rachel Whetstone. She knew that I was going to leave anyway and not hang around. to wait to be fired by David Davis. Yeah. So I think she just said to David Cameron, look, you're the underdog, you've got nothing to lose. Mm. You should ask George to give you a, you know, give you a hand for 6 months. He's respected around the lobby, which you know, I built quite good relations with the lobby at that point. And that's how it came about, really.
Now, during that time, out of interest, David's always famous for the speech he gives, where no notes, he's walking around stage. Now very much the standard setup that you expect of any leader when it comes to any political party. What role did you play out of interest in that? Or was that, it was David just streets ahead in that kind of style and that ability to do that kind of work anyway, out of interest?
Yeah, the great thing about David Cameron is that he was a natural. So he'd had some communications experience himself. Mm. He'd had government experience because he was by Norman Lamont's side during that ERM escapade and all the other issues in government at that point. And the thing about David Cameron is, although I'd always try and brief him and we'd brief him before, you always knew that if he was in front of a camera and he got a left field question about some road scheme or something that he didn't know about, hadn't briefed about, he just had a natural ability to be able to answer it. And if he didn't know, he could give the impression of answering it even though he had not crossed any lines or said anything that he shouldn't have said. And it's just a natural instinctive ability that he had to know how to handle the media. And he also just had this ability of being able to speak from the heart, off the cuff, really without notes or just with a few guide notes. And it was a natural ability he had. We discovered quite early on that if you made him read a script, it was wooden, it looked a bit hammy, it never really worked. And so the conference speeches he did do that were with a script, they never felt right. They'd always felt a bit artificial and a bit forced. Mm. And he was always at his best when you just said, no prep, no notes, get out there, look people in the eye, engage with them from the heart. And he just had a natural ability to do it. So in the end, we said, let's try and forget scripts as far as we can and just let him get out there and do his stuff.
To have a few key talking points, like you say, but ultimately allow him to almost riff a bit off the cuff in regards to...
Exactly. He used to just riff away. He could go there for an hour. And that's why we came up with this concept of Cameron Direct, where he would go out and we would have audiences out in the country of people just to come and meet him and ask him whatever they wanted. And it was a very natural... In fact, we'd borrowed it from... it's something that Richard Nixon did. People forget this, but if you read books going back decades, you always find that there's nothing much new under the sun. Mm. And it was actually Richard Nixon that had perfected this idea in the TV age of doing this kind of campaign where you just get members of the public and you engage with them directly rather than through the filter of an interviewer trying to show off and be clever. And it worked really, really well. And we tried to sort of replicate that kind of approach wherever we could.
I think it's interesting because the more we now look at politics in today's era, it's almost like, it's standard. You know, Donald Trump sort of gets a lot of plaudits for the fact that he would get sell-out crowds, hundreds of thousands, as he would claim, turning up to, obviously, to him. We've seen Keir Starmer recently have his six missions and have an audience, although I did spot Shadow Cabinet and prospective parliamentary candidates, but also Rishi Sunak going on things like the People's Forum, which is on...
But his team, yeah. Rishi's own team will tell you privately they much prefer him in this David Cameron format, Richard Nixon, as they do giving a speech. And I personally think he like, if you watch Rishi, he's better. I'd never really thought that was... I knew that. You say it, but yeah. I'd never really thought back to that. That was one of the ways you positioned David.
Yeah, I forgot.
I think it's exactly the same with Rishi Sunak, that he's fluent on issues. He knows stuff. And he's actually a fluent, competent speaker. And if you put him to engage with people, he can talk with them. Mm. If you give him a script... You know, there'll be some style advisor as well who tells you how to stand and whether to hold the podium or not hold it. And once you get those, my experience is, if you need those sorts of people to be advising, then you've probably got the wrong candidate.
Yeah.
Because you can't just bring in people and think you can make somebody who can't really do it look right. And if you have got somebody who can do it and looks right, well, don't get some style advisor in at vast expense to try and tell them to stand differently or look differently.
Yeah.
Liz Truss had this problem. She got some style advisor for her very first conference speech, and it was, it was a bit cringeworthy because there were pregnant pauses and smiles at the wrong, inappropriate times, and it's because too much of her mind was on how do I look, rather than
what am I
from
doing?
The heart, what am I saying?
Because we both know Michael Gove quite well. I would say he is natural at giving a speech. I mean, he'll do a lot of it himself, but take input on the speech. But he'll just, you don't really need to, having done a conference speech, another speech with him, like, he is someone who can bring a speech to life at a podium.
Yes, and I don't know whether it's because his background is as a journalist, and so he writes in an incredibly elegant way that that actually breaks through to people. Mm. And so maybe the quality of the script is good, and he knows how to deliver it in a way that isn't just looking like he's reading it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's just the quality of the script that he does put a lot of personal effort into getting right that enables him to do it in a slightly different way.
And just on this, the way you positioned David with these camera direct type things, what were the other ways in the early days, whether it was kind of leadership campaign or as you were settling in, what were the other things that you were thinking about? So you had this guy who was, I would guess, relatively unknown to the electorate. You know,
and young as well back then.
Young, and it, you know, people always look back and in hindsight and say it was obvious this was going to happen. It was definitely not obvious David Cameron was going to end up as prime minister when he first got elected as leader.
No.
And so I'm curious. You would have been involved in the conversations. What was the wider positioning of, like, how do we get this guy to be seen as a credible leader, a potential PM?
So we had a very clear message. And one, the first thing is, those of us who knew him knew that he had the sort of, actually the depth and the intellect to do it. And although a lot of the criticism ended up that it was a bit too slick and a bit too PR. We kind of knew that he had the depth and the ability and the judgment to do the role and to do it well. And what we decided really is because, the main players really were, and Ken Clark was a late entry, but people forget, as we arrived at the party conference, the media had assumed that it was going to be Clark versus Davis, and this was just the assumption. In fact, I remember the Sunday Telegraph had a front page story, splash, based on some poll they'd done, dubious poll, that on the Sunday of conference said, it's Clark v. Davis, before we'd even started. And that was basically the highest point that Ken Clark had. And the thing is that David Cameron's one speech just captured the imagination.
That's what people remember, that famous
one
speech.
And it was the big speech at conference, but there was another one 10 days earlier.
Right.
And that is, we consciously took a decision to go head-to-head with David Davis on the same day.
Yeah.
Because we knew that his operation would be a bit more wooden, a bit more flat-footed, and that we wanted to set up this contrast on the same day of being this bright future, thinking about things, doing things differently.
Yeah.
And we had the benefit of Steve Hilton in those days. His strength was in marketing, so, you know, the event looked different, felt different.
Yeah.
The lighting, the quality of everything was better. Mm. Choice of venue was good. They had sort of, didn't just have coffee, miserable coffee out of a thing. They had smoothies being given to journalists and so on. The whole,
what we now call a vibe.
Exactly. The whole thing had a very different vibe, and it felt energy. You felt the energy.
Mm.
And so journalists came to David Cameron's launch that felt really quite, you know, surprisingly fresh and different. And then they walked down the road to, you know, One Great George Street and had the David Davis one, which was flat.
Your kind of standard Westminster.
Your standard Westminster speech read from a script, a bit uncomfortable, too many cooks involved in his speech, the whole thing. So it set up this contrast, which we deliberately wanted. And that was when we started to get some, you know, spring in.
And just, if you can think back, when you go into conference and you wake up on the Sunday and you yourself, you go, when you went to work for David, you're the underdogs and you see the headline, which is Clark v. Davis. Were you, as a team, were you still like, no, we know we've, because all of us have worked on campaigns and you can feel when you've got a bit of momentum.
Yeah.
And so I personally think if you're strong-minded and, you know, you mentioned Dominic Cummings could be accused of a lot of things. He can't be accused of not being strong-minded. When you're on a campaign, you know if you've got a bit of momentum. Not that you're definitely going to win, but you can feel it. Did you feel kind of, oh no, you know, maybe we haven't really got a chance, or did you actually look at the paper and think these guys don't really understand what's going on?
A bit of both. Okay. So on the one hand, you know, it's quite possible for the party to get things wrong and choose the wrong person, and for the the weight of the
media.
Is there
any in particular?
I'm not going to go into that. But the weight of kind of media assumptions about things can lead to a sort of foregone conclusion, and the right candidate can't get a fair hearing and never gets a look in. That happens.
Yeah.
And so there's always a risk that happens. So you might believe passionately that your candidate's the right one, but you might look at it and think, well, okay, the media narrative is what it is, and we can't fight that. But in David's case, we knew that we had made quite a breakthrough with the launch 10 days earlier.
Okay.
In that the commentary out was starting to say, this is really interesting, it's really different. If the Tory party's got any sense, they would choose this guy.
Mm.
And then we also knew as we went into that weekend, the starter conference, that Newsnight had done some dial groups, as they called them,
which
is a form of polling where you turn a dial to see whether you like or dislike somebody.
As you're watching like a speech. Or
and they had basically tested all of the potential candidates.
Mm.
And David Cameron came out massively ahead. And we knew that result, and it ran on the Monday night of conference.
Mm.
And that basically changed the perceptions. And we literally got those results, printed them on paper, and went around hotel rooms pushing them under the doors of members so that they could see this polling evidence during conference.
Yeah.
And that was quite powerful because our message wasn't so much David Cameron stands for XYZ, although there was a bit of that.
Mm.
The headline message was change to win.
Yeah.
Because what we were saying to the Conservative Party is, look, if we want to win, we've got to change. We can't just keep navel-gazing and worrying about work. We've got to connect with the public.
Mm.
And so change to win was the message, and demonstrating that David Cameron could be a winner was actually what the party was crying out for at that stage.
Mm.
And that is a message we went for.
So I'll pick you up on that. When we've seen recent leadership kind of campaigns, we've seen this, what was the Boris one? Remember Boris's?
I can't remember his.
But I was thinking Ready for Rishi, like Liz was around her name. But David's was more around a central message for the party rather than being, you know, kind of prepare for Cameron, or I can't think of anything catchy off the top of my head. But, you know, it was more change to win is different than the ones we've maybe seen recently. That's more like really focused on what the party needs to do as a campaign message.
Yes, and I think that's right, because I think there's a danger. And it happens when you know, if you have too many American advisors or even, dare I say, Australian advisors, they tend to think it's slightly more presidential.
Yeah.
Australia's not got a presidential system, but they tend to think much more around the individual and the
presidential style.
Treat it like a presidential style. And I think that's a mistake. And so what we were trying to convey with David Cameron wasn't that here comes President Cameron.
Mm.
We the party should change.
Mm.
And, you know, he can help us change, but you've got a part in it too.
Yeah.
You know, and a consistent part of David Cameron's message on every front, whether it was policy or indeed his dealings with the party, it was like, we've got a role to play here. There's a shared responsibility. I'll do my bit. You need to do your bit as well.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just sit there sniping and thinking the leader can do it.
We're together.
The whole party needs to change, and I can lead that change, but I need you to come with me.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important for a political party under our system, that you recognise we have a party leader, we're not electing a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
And often that's forgotten.
Mm.
And it's often forgotten because you have foreign advisors who don't understand the British constitution properly.
Mm. That's really interesting.
Do you think that's a mistake that could be easily fallen into in terms of what we've seen in recent times? Have we fallen into a trap of it becoming more presidential in recent years rather than going back to, as you say, a pitch to a party, not just its leader, not just its own MPs, but also its members having a mindset change as well?
Potentially, but it was always difficult. So under Michael Howard and David Cameron, if the polls turned against you, you didn't have to wait long before there'd be sniping from your MPs, sniping from members, people complaining about CCHQ and they weren't doing this and not doing that. So that we've always had this problem as a party. In fact, though, all parties have this, that when the chips are down and you need people to rally around and support you, they tend not to. not in the numbers you would like. They tend to lay into you based on, a transitory change in the polls, based on an equally transitory change in the media narrative. And so there's always been that challenge. I mean, what I'd say is, I think although often people run leadership campaigns in a presidential style, which I think is a mistake, our constitution consistently reminds them that we don't have a presidential system.
Mm.
And so, you know, when Theresa May basically lost the confidence of the party, she was gone. the same for Boris Johnson. You know, I remain loyal to Boris to the end, but after that first vote of no confidence, he kind of needed to understand that he was in quite a bit of trouble when, you know, when sort of a third of his own party were voting against him on a no confidence. But he didn't really put the effort in to try and make people feel valued. It was a sort of, I've won, you know, that's it sort of thing. And of course, then it ended, you know, shortly after. So, and the same is true with Liz Truss. You know, she formed a cabinet based on allies. She didn't want any
I don't think they really
compromised with other bits of the party. But
no, I think that's
true. It then meant that, you know, huge swathes of the parliamentary party felt alienated, and she was downed shortly after. So you've got to recognise that under our system, a prime minister only exists while they have the confidence of parliament in general, but their own political party in particular. And that the day they lose that, they're gone.
That's true. And so you get through, you get this underdog elected, but you're now confronted with the fact that, great, he's leader, but you're on the bounce of three defeats. You're a long way from there for being, as we discussed, this being perceived as ready for government. You're not, I think that's fair to say, you're not there. And so how that transition is what I'm really interested in. How do you, what, in your own words, how would you describe, as if you don't mind, when we spoke about that, what would you characterise as being a kind of party of opposition? And what's the difference between that with being then moving to a party of government, as we discussed?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing I'd say is it's quite difficult unslumping yourself when you go into opposition, particularly if it's after a big defeat, as the Conservatives had in 97, you know, and Labour had, you know, really in 2010. Because the first thing that happens is you lose a lot of quite good MPs.
Yeah.
And you lose MPs who are in marginal seats, who tend to be more attuned to public opinion and better connected with the public. And so you end up left with the safe seat MPs who probably do less canvassing, or in some cases no canvassing at all, probably don't understand the mood of the country at large and have a small echo chamber in their safe seat. And so there's a tendency to turn inwards and to go through a period of navel-gazing, sort of, what are we about? What do we stand for? What does it mean to be conservative? And the trouble is that in our system, the first-past-the-post system, all of the big political parties are quite broad coalitions. We have a coalition. We have coalition government, but it's inside the party rather than between parties. And so the Conservative Party's a coalition of blue-collar Tories, working-class Tories, you know, libertarians, free trade obsessives, Shire Tories who are worried about shooting. It's quite a broad coalition. And so it's quite hard, actually, to say, this is what we believe, this is what we're about. And so, but they tend to go through a period of navel-gazing on that. The other thing is, you suddenly lose a resource of government, and so you're left with a handful of people. So in opposition, you know, you'll have whatever's in, for the Conservatives, it was the Conservative Research Department, but a few desk officers, you know, probably a dozen or two dozen people, similar in the press office, and they have to keep the show on the road and deal with everything under the sun. And so they're very, our political parties are very under-resourced for what we expect them to do and for what we expect an opposition party to do, really. So there's that challenge. But the things you have to, and then there are wider challenges. If you come up with a good idea, the government nicks it, announces it, and takes the credit. And there's nothing more galling than having worked on a policy that's really good. You announce it and it sort of gets a whimper. You know, 2 months later, the government announced it, and it's top item on the 10 o'clock news and lots of analysis, and they take the credit for the work you've done. And then if you announce something that's got a problem in it, a flaw that you had missed, and it comes unstuck and backfires, well, there's a surety that that's all you're going to be asked about when you do the media for months after months. And so you have this problem that things you come up with that don't work out are hung around your neck, and anything good, the government bank can take the credit for. So it's a real, really difficult challenge. And so oppositions go through periods of trying to travel light. Don't say too much because it'll either backfire or the other lot will nick it. So be careful what you say. And then they go through periods of thinking, we've got to say something. And the way we tended to do that, and Labour have done the same, is you launch reviews. We have policy groups. And we've brought in all sorts of external experts. And it's great when you launch them. You've got all these expert people coming in and they're going to give you advice. You know, until you've got their report. And then you end up saying things like, this is an interesting contribution to the debate. Or something like that, because basically there's problems in what's recommended and you have to try and distance yourself from it.
Yeah.
So it's quite a difficult thing to be in as opposition, to be able to say things that are, you know, not just sniping at the government, but to say substantive things about policy that are original, but to do so in a way that doesn't shackle you to it because it could come unstuck. And there isn't an easy answer, but probably that sort of policy group review type approach, if you structure it well, is the best way. But you've got to be very careful who leads those reviews because you know, you end up with having to manage things you'd rather not.
It's also a problem in government, isn't it? When you you launch some great review and then you get the document back and you're like, we can't do half of this.
No. Well, I always used to caution against reviews for that reason because you get a bit of coverage on the day and it feels good, but when it comes back, you know, you're always tearing your hair out. How are we going to manage this? And, you know, normally the well-trodden line is it's an interesting contribution to the debate. And that's, you know, that's quite difficult.
And out of interest, obviously, you said about the sort of the staffing levels when you're in there and, you're picking up really sort of a skeleton crew initially. How quickly, when you came in with David Cameron, was that built up already by Michael Howard previously? Or was it an entirely new team coming in and, sort of who is in the inner sanctum, as it were, you know, in terms of policy ideas? Is it by this stage you've got your George Osborne's, your David Cameron's-esque and, you know, Michael Gove even and stuff starting to feed in ideas? Or is it still very much those policy advisors, those groups that have been set up that are feeding in different views?
Probably, and he's not given enough credit for it, but Michael Howard did a huge amount to just get some professionalism in the party machine. You know, in the end, it didn't come off for him, and he wasn't able to communicate the change that people needed because they remembered him as the Home Secretary. But what he did do, because he's a real stickler, you know, Michael Howard, he got, you know, discipline, focus, just ability in the machine. So he built up a team of quite good advisors, and we worked very hard to strengthen the, you know, and test and strengthen the skills of the team in the press office. So I used to run drills where I would basically time, if something went on the press association and it was a government announcement, basically time how long it took us to get a response. And I would literally monitor it almost like a, because the press officer needed to get on to the shower account, needed to get an answer, and we needed to get it on there. And we used to have a view that you need to try and do that within 30 minutes and try and drill people to do that. And if you found that something had gone awry and it took us 6 hours to get a response, well, why was that? And why weren't we getting people on the, you know, on the broadcast to be clipped and in the packages? So we really worked hard on building that sort of skill set. And the other thing in opposition, I think, and you lose this when you go in government in some way, in opposition, you're all in the trenches together. You've got a bunch of typically 20-something people, many of whom it's their first job after leaving uni. It's a tight team. You know, they have to live through disasters together, uncomfortable things together. They work and they really bond quite well if you do it well. And that gives you a sort of strength of purpose, a kind of cohesion across the team. Of course, when you get into government, everyone goes into departments and you get Whitehall kind of turf wars going on and that starts to dissipate, that sort of bonding that you get. So we did quite a lot of work, actually, in opposition to build the capability of the team. And then when David Cameron came in, he brought some key people with him. So notably, you know, it was Steve Hilton was the new addition. And he very quickly decided that Oliver Letwin would give the intellectual ballast on the policy. And he was like the mainframe computer, they used to call him sometimes, the sort of holder of all the policy detail. And then Steve Hilton used to give the sort of marketing flair, for want of a better term. And that sort of worked well. And then you had Ed Llewellyn as the, you know, as the chief of staff. And I've always think you need a chief of staff needs to be a sort of worrier, somebody who's worried that everything's going about to go wrong and disaster.
Yeah.
Michael Howard had that in Stephen Sherborne, who is a long-standing, you know, advisor to, I think, 5 prime ministers, have seen a lot of stuff go wrong. And you need that mix of a bit of marketing flair from somebody who's like either a political secretary or equivalent, a worrier who sort of is the voice of caution. And then, you know, in my role as the press secretary, it was somebody who could, you know, basically maintain those relations with the media and get the message out there.
Because the challenge, as you've pointed out, is you're always responding essentially on the back foot. You're responding to what the government of the day is setting, as you did with under Blair and then Brown with David Cameron. And then, of course, trying, as you say, set your own narrative and policy position, and the closer you get to election, sort of showing a bit more ankle, as it were, to the electorate, on the hope that the government still doesn't come and grab the idea, essentially then wiping under your feet and, you know, swiping from under your feet. And I suppose what I'm intrigued is those advisors that you talked about, how easy is it to bring people into a party? Because as James said, it's not clear David Cameron, when he first come in, is ever going to be Prime Minister. The Conservatives have been on a running streak for a while. How easy is it to go out there and recruit very talented, maybe young up-and-comers, but also experienced heads as well, to hang around when essentially there's probably money on the table in other roles outside of politics that would be much more enticing? How do you bring those people in? Also, how do you fund it? Because there's been reports recently that, for example, some of these Labour policy advisors, as they're called, are being funded through some of the think tanks that are affiliates to the Labour Party. Like, how is that funded? Is it leave the opposition's office? Is it CCHQ? Or is it, as I say, maybe nowadays would it be certain maybe think tanks that would be more empathetic to a Conservative government, so to speak?
Yeah. So I don't think any of the two leaders I work for, they didn't really have difficulty getting talent, in that the people that can actually do those roles, it's a very specialist thing, and it tends to be people who've done it before at the senior level. So you've got your graduates who come in and they're, you know, you train them up. But for the big roles, like Rachel Whetstone did and Steve Hilton, you know, they all had experience of being in CRD. They kind of got, they knew the drill. And so I think you can recruit those people. And the party, you know, they paid reasonably well, actually, for the top roles. So they were able to get that talent without too much, I would say, without too much difficulty. And because of by that stage, you know, we were already, you know, close to 10 years in opposition, there was a bit of a sort of, come on, guys, we've got to get this together. So I think that was okay. And it was quite straightforward. For if you're a leader who's just been elected, you've got immense authority at that moment. And it's very easy for you to choose the shadow cabinet that you want, to bring in the advisors that you want. There might be murmurings about it, but people aren't going to really second guess it. It's accepted that the leader's office it's personal to the leader. They've got to be able to bring in the people that they think can do it. So I think we didn't really have much difficulty on that front. But you know, we wrestled very much early on with Steve Hilton. I remember was particularly taken with looking at graphs of all the previous Conservative leaders since 97. And basically all of them had a reasonable start for a couple of months and then tanked and fell out of favour and never recovered. So he was obsessed with this sort of 100-day thing that we basically had 3 months to establish David Cameron and get into a better place, and that we couldn't waste that time. So for the first sort of 3 to 6 months, we threw everything at trying to sort of establish David Cameron's position. And we ruthlessly chose different themes, one around the environment, one around economy, one around sort of third sector charity. And we had a ruthless thing, which is anything you announced had to fit one of these five themes. There's always got to be five themes, as we all know, whether you're opposition or government. So it had to fit one of the, and it literally color-coded as to what message we were trying to convey. And we also wrestled with how you deal with things like PMQs. So at one point, you know, we had a view that you should just do worthy stuff about international development and foreign policy, take all the Punch and Judy show out of it, project David Cameron as a serious person asking serious questions. If it didn't get on the news, great, because the spectacle of PMQs just undermines, basically, I think...
Turn off the voters, right?
Exactly. The public don't really warm to it. They just look at it and then they're all just falling out. So that was our approach. We tried it for a while, but it wasn't long before you had your own backbenchers whinging and moaning that, you know, they wanted meat and they wanted, you know, blood on the carpet sort of thing. So David Cameron then had to sort of play the game, and Punch and Judy was back. So it's very tricky how you do this as an opposition, because everybody wants to know what you think about what the government's doing, and the media always come to you sort of, you know, can I have your reaction to the government? Mm. And you've got to give that because you're the opposition and that's part of your role. But you also want to be conveying something about what you would do. And it's a tricky balance to get when everybody's trying to pull you into, you know, that role of being a sniping opposition, to be able to be a government in waiting saying stuff. And I think this is something David Cameron did very well. I think Tony Blair did it very well. I actually don't think that Keir Starmer has done it well. I think he's conscious of the need to try and do it, but I don't think they've managed to do it yet because they haven't resolved this issue of how they talk about things in an intelligent way without it all coming unstuck. So they're still at the stage of saying as little as possible.
I was about to say that with Keir Starmer, for example, you talk about the Punch and Judy elements, and I think because he probably is being pushed by his backbenchers, has fallen into the trap of when he makes discerning comments about the Prime Minister being, you know, short, or like the jumped up milk monitor comment. I just think, isn't that falling into the very trap that you say, that you turn it into like some petulant spectacle rather than actually, I'm a serious politician of a serious time and therefore projecting this idea that a Prime Minister in waiting, whereas in, I think Rishi on Broadly has done a very good job of, particularly as we saw in the week we're recording this, with the blood infection scandal, you know, being very serious, being very contrite, being apologetic unreservedly, so is appropriate, but projecting that very sense of serious image as well to the public.
Absolutely. There were times, when David Cameron took quite a conscious position to support, you know, the Blair government on things because he felt, and he always had this term that you are, in those days, Her Majesty's loyal opposition, and that there were certain moments when the opposition had a duty actually to stand together with the country on things and with the government of the day on things. And so he did do that sometimes. And I do think that, well, Keir Starmer, I think, suffers probably, it's the lawyer's trait. You know, he's a barrister by training, and it's kind of turn up on the day, who am I representing today? What's the best case? What's the best spin I can put on this particular person I'm representing? And it's quite hard sometimes for a lawyer to get out of that. So rather than thinking, if you want to be Prime Minister, rather than thinking, you know, what do I say to make the case for this? You need to be thinking, what's the right thing to do? What do my convictions tell me are the right thing to do? And a Prime Minister will often, you know, in fact, every day, have to make judgments on things where the knowledge, the data, the evidence is imperfect. The decision ends up on their desk because nobody else can take it because it's too tricky. It's a hellish job where you have to take just difficult decisions. And prime ministers, all of them, have to regularly sort of just go back into their own heart and convictions and say, you know, what's the right thing to do here and do it. And I think Keir Starmer might struggle with that just because he's a lawyer and it's too much... what do I say to represent X, Y, or Z line rather than, you know, what should we do? What's the right thing to do?
I think we have seen that quite regularly because even if you speak to the lobby as well, I think their observation is they might run into trouble in the election because we all know in a campaign, you've got the government are used to it. Let's say something happens today that's big. And number 10, to your point about timing the press team, they've got half an hour or an hour or two to decide what the Prime Minister thinks about it. Because you can't wait longer than that because the press are onto them. Because Labour kind of have like sometimes 2 days, really, or at least one press cycle of a day, I think we've seen them scratch around for, to your point about Keir, which side should I represent? You know, where should I go on this? Rather than, and I think they're going to struggle with that in the campaign.
Yeah, and you can't train someone to do that or be different. So, you know, to be honest with both Michael Howard and David Cameron, when push came to shove, you kind of knew that in the end, there was a sort of irreducible kind of core, which was what they were about, what they stood for. And they would, both of them say, No. We're not going to do that. This is the right thing to do. I'm not going to play stupid politics with this. And you needed that sort of grown-up approach of somebody to say, I'm not going to play sort of playground stuff. We need to show some dignity in this. And I think Keir Starmer does struggle with that, particularly on some of his, as you said,
I think
personal
his own
sort of jibes against the PM. It just doesn't.
It doesn't land.
I think his own shadow cabinet would struggle with
the
that.
Campaign though. No,
I agree with you. I think you've got, you've got what? The morning news cycle, then the midday news cycle, then the 6 o'clock news, then the 10 o'clock news. So you have literally hour, maybe two, to have a response, have a line, and have it consistently pushed out. You've also got shadow cabinet ministers who, in this current case, Wes Streeting was a classic example on the day before the London mayoral election, tweeting out about white supremacists and extremists, you know, voting for Susan Hall, essentially, you know, things like that are going to come out in the campaign. How does Labour respond to that when Keir Starmer is trying to project, I'm Prime Minister in waiting? But this says, essentially, for the Conservative Party will push, this is the same old Labour Party, the student union politics that hasn't actually left them, and these people want to, you know, potentially be the government in power, which international, you know, allies or even foes are going to take these people seriously at the end of the day. And I think that's where there's going to be a big challenge. And I think that's where I remember, sort of, I grew up, I joined the party in 08 when I turned 18. So David Cameron obviously was, you know, I don't really remember much of opposition. I suppose I've been a spoilt Conservative Party member by having a period in
natural party of government.
So, like, and I think as a member, you don't know. So listening to what George is saying is fascinating because, you know, unless I go back and sort of remember my studying days, I don't really know what it's actually be like to remember. You know, 08, I think you could see we were turning a corner, and Gordon Brown coming in was seen as an asset, I think, to our electoral hopes over Blair, who was just slick and smooth and kind of, you know, being seen to just constantly be, in my lifetime, be a winner. Whereas in Brown wasn't that in my head. And therefore, it was the first time I thought, right, we could actually get this over the line. I suppose that's the challenge there then, George, is how, when Brown comes in, what's the mindset change then? Is it now a sense of relief, Blair's gone? Mm. Or is it a sense of Blair and Brown have been a team? They're the ones who kind of, you know, they were close allies. They worked their way through. Yes, Brown's been desperately waiting for his moment in the sun. And therefore, but because he's been around for so long, because he's been the chancellor for so long, do you start to think, actually, this guy's going to really struggle to project a future vision that's different?
It was the opposite. And that's because we knew all along that the media would behave in an irrational way and give Gordon Brown a honeymoon. Whether or not he deserved it, and he did. So when he came in, I don't know when it was, around about June 2007, the Daily Mail thought he was amazing, front pages about how marvellous he was going to cancel the Blair Force One aeroplane and all this sort of stuff. And so Gordon Brown enjoyed a three-month honeymoon where he could do no wrong and everybody thought he was a master. And then suddenly that put us on the back foot because the media was only saying, oh, well, David Cameron's just a... you know, a showman, and it's all stunts, and it's all... And we got stuck in this difficult place of you know, suddenly David Cameron was wrong-footed and made to look almost insubstantial compared to Gordon Brown. It was a bizarre thing. Now, we knew that was irrational, and we knew that the media coverage was totally irrational, but it was nevertheless a reality, and one that we predicted. So when we were wargaming it in April, May, we knew that we were going to have this problem with a Brown bounce. And we did, and of course, Gordon Brown nearly called an election.
That was the big moment, right, for him to...
He nearly called an election that, you know, the following following autumn. And, in fact, he probably would have won it if he'd had the courage to go for it. But luckily, because of his personal flaws, he dithered and failed and couldn't make the decision, and the moment passed. You know, and the rest is history. But it was very, very uncomfortable for us because... You know, the media narrative, it's a bit, we used to compare it to market sentiment down in the city. It's a bit like, you know, if the stock market's going up and up and up, it doesn't matter if companies are getting poor results, the share price still goes up. Mm. Equally, if the sentiment changes, you could have companies doing very well and the share price still goes down. And it's just like that in politics, that media sentiment, which then drives public opinion... You know, media sentiment is often quite irrational and not rooted in the fundamentals. And the prevailing media narrative, you don't know how long you're going to have to put up with it when it's a downer on you. And it can be, you know, very, very difficult to manage.
And out of interest, in that time, are you starting to get MPs on the door with the Brown bouncer? You know, you said that MPs kind of like desperately want their red meat. At this stage, are you getting
the
worries? Because I'm assuming with opposition... MPs are much more sensitive than normal to what the media is saying, because ultimately when you're in government, you're controlling things, whereas in your position, you're reacting to things. So are you getting door knockers of like, oh, this is all not working? And you know,
absolutely, straight away, yeah. I mean, I can remember actually, David Cameron, because he foresaw this problem, and when he became leader, he talked to all the previous Conservative leaders and tried to, you know, he wanted to learn from their mistakes. You know, what did you do that worked and what didn't work and how did you find it? And he actually put the time in to talk to them all. And he invested a lot of time early on to make the parliamentary party feel valued and part of things and invited them to, you know, receptions. There was a lot done to try and create a collegiate atmosphere. But as soon as the Gordon Brown came in and the polls started to go against us, panic set in immediately within weeks. Really. And so within about a month of Gordon Brown being there, there was chatter about how, you know, David Cameron had to be replaced, had to go, had to, you know, more red meat, had to do this, had to do that. And I can remember being in the car, looking at the headlines, and he just said to me, well, he said, this is what all the other leaders said would happen, that something will go wrong and then everyone will be on your back straight away. So it was a very uncomfortable period for us, through that. And, and they changed, they panicked a bit and did some things they shouldn't, so they slightly abandoned the approach we were taking with the media. We were trying to have a different sort of relationship with the media that was less sort of incestuous, for want of a better term, less kind of, doing deals with Murdoch and so on, and just much more arm's length. And that sort of went out the window during that period of panic. And we ended up, I left that autumn, Andy Coulson was brought in. It was a much more than, tabloid-centric, get-the-headlines agenda after that period, which I think was a shame, because I think they lost something that we had that was valuable. But, this is what happens when you get a move against your position and your own parliamentary party panicking. There was quite a bit of sort of panic and a sense that we needed to do things differently.
And so just to kind of end on, I think when you look back, I'm curious, you've had a decade at the top of government and, ministerial roles and been in department, but you had this time, you said yourself, I think this on campaigns, there's nothing like working on a kind of campaign. And it sounds a bit like being with the leader of the opposition is a kind of essentially a long campaign. And there's a camaraderie that you get with that you simply don't get in government, is a spad. You've got 2-3 other people that you work with daily and so on. And I wonder, when you look back on it, is that like a fond time for you? How do you compare that to your time in government, which obviously they're quite different roles?
Yeah. I'm not sure fond is the word I'd use, because at the time, it was stressful. And you've been impressed as well. The times in those, I was in my 30s, but if you would take a girl out on a date for dinner on a Saturday, you'd be condemned to be walking up and down on the pavement outside the restaurant on the phone because something had blown up in the Sunday papers. and that was just day in, day out, kind of, something would blow up on you and you'd be stuck dealing with it. And you just had to have, you were a slave to your phone. As a press officer, there's about 150 people who've all got your mobile number and they hound you into the ground relentlessly. So, but it was also incredibly formative. And there's a difference. I think our constitution is designed really that in opposition, it enables an opposition party to choose a leader that it can unite behind. And then just the process of opposition itself tests a leader of the opposition to destruction. To see whether they actually could make the top job and become prime minister. And it also creates this bond of trust, that there's a bond between, a group of people. There's always a tight group of about half a dozen people who keep the show on the road around any leader's office. But around that, then a wider hinterland of, a couple of dozen people, probably not much more than that, but who basically are, in the trenches doing all the heavy lifting.
Kind of foot soldiers.
Exactly, the foot soldiers. When those people, those advisors go into government, you've got that collegiate thing around the leader and it gives you your best chance to get stuff done. So I think, our system is designed that parties choose leaders in opposition. The great weakness of our system, of course, is a lot of government policies written in opposition. And they don't have access to really the information they need to make those policies. Yeah. So to be fair to Labour now, but also to the Conservatives when we were in opposition, you've just got no resources really to develop a coherent manifesto plan. And you've got tens of thousands of civil servants that'll be sat on their hands waiting for these tablets of wisdom to come down during an election campaign the first week. So they can put it in their little lever arch files, with the Royal Ensign on the front and lots of briefing about how to deliver X, Y, or Z. But actually, the big weakness is that the people who are drafting that policy are doing it on the fly without anything like the sort of resources that the parties really need to do it justice. Yeah, and then you know, then that, the manifesto becomes the guide for government. And the tens of thousands of people in government who could have told you, well, I wouldn't do that because of this. Suddenly they tell you that when it's too late.
Yeah. I think I kind of saw a little bit of that on Vote Leave. I remember Paul saying to me when we were trucking along, but the government hadn't really come into the Remain, kind of focusing on government. And Paul said, Stevenson said, you'll feel it when they get involved. Because it's like, and it was like a tidal wave because, as you said, the resources they've got. But also, I mean, what was our policy team on Vote Leave? It was like five people. And you're up against multiple government departments producing all kinds of stuff. And it is like, it's a huge difference. It's difficult.
It is. And the comparison of it, but an opposition, if it's got good people, can deal with that. And we had this when I was, my first job in Business for Sterling, the anti-euro campaign, we actually totted it up once and we realised that a small group of us, it was about a dozen, you know, we're up against about 3,500 civil servants because the government had, at those days, 3,500 people preparing to join the euro, working out how to do it, to market it. Yeah, it was like, you know, prepare and decide was the thing. But basically, Tony Blair really wanted to join the euro come what may, even if it was a stupid idea. And there was a vast number of people working on get ready for the euro. And there was huge campaigns about getting ready to join the euro. And so we were just massively outgunned. But what we learned quite early on is the kind of guerrilla campaign that's got a handful of people that knows what it's doing can actually take apart the government machine quite effectively when it puts its mind to it. Yeah. And that's because the government machine, for all its thousands of people, struggles to make a decision.
Struggles to be agile
when under fire. And so the government machine and Vote Leave proved this as well. You know, Dominic Cummings was ruthless at saying, you know, we can predict how they, you know, we know how they will react to this. And if we do this, they will do that. And that's a stupid thing to do. And then there's the coup de, you know, the tie at the end. So, I think, you know, there's benefits to being that agile group of people that haven't got cumbersome processes. It's a bit like a sort of, you know, an SAS team against some sort of conscript army in some ways when it comes to campaigning.
No, it is. And as Dom said, they're predictable. I was thinking there's a scene in Die Hard when they're trying to take the building, Nakatomi Tower, and the criminals are in there. It was Alan Rickman. And they're like, how are we going to get the power off? And the FBI come in and he's like, ladies and gentlemen, I give the FBI. The first thing they always do is turn the power off, which is what they need to get the vaults. But it's to your point, it's with the government. They're so predictable. So when you're up against them, it's like, how are we going to get them to do this? It's like, we know, we'll do this. Exactly. And they'll 100% react this way.
They will react without thinking what will happen in three or four steps down the line.
Yeah.
And that's why, but you need people that can think around corners. And obviously you and I both worked with Dominic Cummings.
Yeah.
He was a talented campaigner for that reason, that he could think around corners and knew how the system would react to particular interventions.
Yeah. But in Westminster, is nothing if predictable a lot of the time. George, that was amazing. I there's so much, so much I hadn't thought about. Really interesting. And also, you know, I think it's kind of the time period now where it's a really interesting point. Obviously, David Cameron's kind of come back, but it's kind of got that distance that it's interesting to look back on it now as over as kind of over a decade ago. Thanks so much for joining us. Really enjoyable.
Thank you, George. And hope you all enjoyed those who tuned in and listened. Make sure that you hit follow or subscribe, however it is that you're listening to your podcast. Make sure you leave us a rating and a review. And of course, you can follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @WhitehallPodUK.